Texting between two different kinds of phones makes photos blurry, ugly, and security risky. Not just that, it also makes video calling, editing messages, or leaving a group nearly impossible. With WhatsApp, everyone can enjoy seamless messaging with the protection of end-to-end encryption. Streamline your messages across all devices on WhatsApp. Message privately with anyone you want. Click the banner or download now to learn more.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. What goes through the mind of a killer when they commit murder? Based on the massively successful Netflix documentary series of the same name, this book features 10 of the most compelling cases from the first two series and is full of exclusive, never-seen-before material. The authors, Ned Parker and Danny Tipping, secured exceptional access to high-security prisons across America. The majority of the killers will die in prison, either by serving their sentence of life without parole, or they are on death row, waiting to be executed. In each of the cases, the inmate speaks openly about themselves and reflects on their life and their crimes. To gain a complete picture of the impact of the murders, the authors spoke to both the families of both the perpetrators and the victims, and those in law enforcement who were involved in the case, leaving it up to the reader to make up their own mind about the killers and their crimes. The book draws on handwritten letters from the inmates and full transcripts of the interviews to tell each story, and features exclusive material, including personal pictures, crime scene images, and original police and court documents. This is a fascinating and detailed look at some of America's most gripping murder cases. The book that we're featuring this evening is I Am a Killer, Inside the Mind of Murderers, with my special guests, documentary film producers and authors, Danny Tipping and Ned Parker. Thank you very much for this interview and welcome to the program, Danny Tipping and Ned Parker.
Thank you for having us.
Lovely to meet you, Dan.
Thank you very much and congratulations on this book, I Am a Killer. Let's start off with the genesis of this book. Why did you both decide to write this book?
We've been producing the series I'm a Killer for Netflix since back in 2017, when we started into pre-production on the series. And we'd generated a lot of stories and that you can see as part of that series now in its fourth season. There were elements of the story that we couldn't always get to in a 40 or 50 minute documentary that we still wanted to explore and share with people. And also because of the success of the series, obviously that gave us an opportunity to do that. So we got together with a publisher and sort of started setting about selecting stories from the first couple of series that we could expand upon for the book.
Tell us about the criteria that you used to include these 10 stories.
We were really interested with I Am a Killer in looking at stories which are not the sort of stories necessarily normally covered in kind of true crime broadcasting. We were looking for stories which had a unknown largely unknown to the public, but which touched on kind of bigger themes, which told us a little bit more about a kind of a bigger topic than necessarily just the individual and their murder. So we looked for stories which could kind of, yeah, for example, the James Robertson is the first episode of the first series, and he also appears in the book. He was somebody who appears at first glance as a complete monster. And I think our approach to these was we wanted to find stories where you could say, okay, yes, he's done horrific things and awful things, but no matter how awful he is still a human being. He's not a caricature. He is a human being, and there is something human within it. And the important thing was to try and kind of find that and see if there was something that you could relate to, not necessarily meaning that you found empathy or sympathy for him, but you could certainly relate to the kind of the human motivations in his life. So we were setting out to look for those stories, and we were keen, there are some things that we were going to go to, were there, Danny? We weren't very clear. We weren't going to include any killers who were unwilling to admit what they'd done, or at least the broad context of what they'd done. The point right. was that they had to speak openly and say, yeah, I took another person's life, because we didn't want to get into the kind of whodunit or proving them or, you know, the gotcha moments. It was like, no, if you can at least start with the fact that, yes, you admit you killed somebody's life, then I think there's something we can learn from that person. So that was the first kind of criteria. And we wrote to thousands of people across the US, and everything was done by a handwritten letter at the time. And it took a long time for those responses to go back and forth. So somebody who admitted what they'd done, somebody who hadn't been involved in a mass shooting or a terrorist thing or anything which could inspire somebody else into a kind of a copycat killing. We also didn't want anyone who was involved with sexual violence crimes, rape, etc., or anything involving children, any infanticide, because our point was not to try and kind of campaign for these individuals, but to allow a viewer to be able to view them, as I say, as human. And I think there are some crimes which are just too difficult for you, anybody, to sit and say, right, within 45 minutes of the film, I can watch this and I can relate to this person at all. You know, there are some things that make them thoroughly unrelatable. So that was kind of our criteria. And we started on with people who received death sentences and were either on death row or had been on death row. And by season two, we expanded that out a little bit. One of the reasons was we also wanted to have female voices, because although most murders, by far, run away, most murders are committed by men, there is something very different about the female experience and motivations and causes for a woman to take another person's life. So we started looking at that. We included some female cases in the second series and also the third and fourth series as well. So we'd had a lot of different stories when we were looking at now bringing it to a book. We wanted to select those which we thought kind of supported each other in showing, we're not sure a thesis is the right word, but a kind of a what we discovered as being the kind of the commonalities of cause which lead people to making these horrific decisions.
Yeah, and I think the book, within the 10 stories in the book from, you know, from the 20 episodes in the first two series, it's a good cross section. It gives you a kind of a, I think, a taste or an overview of what we're trying to do in the series. And they're sort of contrasting stories, but of course there are lots of commonalities. As we've said often, that, you know, the extreme poverty, physical, mental and sexual abuse in the home, drug and alcohol abuse, you know, they obviously these come up time and time again when you're looking at convicted felons and killers, and not that any of those hardships excuse or lessen the you know, the horrendous crimes they've committed, but it starts giving you a picture of how somebody could get to the point where they're able to take another human life. And that was something that we hadn't looked at before. Ned hadn't actually, until he came onto I'm a Killer, done true crime. I'd done a bit of true crime documentary making, and we hadn't spent a lot of time, we'd spent no time at all actually talking to the killers and just finding their motivations. We were much more engaged with like a lot of true crime in the actual mechanics of the murder and the investigation that happens afterwards. So I guess the idea for this series was to start at the other end, to start with the killers, find out how they got to the point where they could take a life. And at every point, the biggest character, I guess, in these shows is the victim, that we're absolutely sensitive to the victim and their families and the events that have led to them losing a loved one. So it's a lot to juggle actually in a single story. And I guess that, coming back to the book, we're able to expand a little bit on those stories in a book that, in a way that we weren't able to perhaps in a, you know, 45, 50 minute documentary. So viewers of the series will see that we've gone into a little bit more detail on each of the cases they might already be familiar with.
Another thing which is down, which is different with the book to the documentary series itself, is with the documentaries, we kind of established a format. in which you hear firstly the voice of the killer, and then that's about the first 10 to 15 minutes or so of each film. And then you hear in turn the voices of other people connected to the case, be they, related to the victim, related to the killer, investigators, prosecution, defense, whoever they are, they might be. But you only hear from them one at a time. And the reason we did that is we kind of based it off our experiences is by having done jury duty. And in a criminal trial, you'll have a witness will come forward and they'll give their testimony and then they're gone. So you don't kind of hear from them again. And obviously more traditional kind of true crime documentaries, you'll hear, voices all kind of cut together and you get little bits here and there and everywhere else. But we thought this idea of taking these journeys, the viewer has to kind of pay attention and listen. So okay, something that you've heard 15 minutes into the film might not have relevance until later on, but you have to kind of pay attention to it and you're not going to hear from that person again. And we found that structure worked really well for the documentaries. That's what we continue to do. It's what we think, it makes this a series of films work well. But of course, it means that if somebody's talking to you about an element of the story and they come in early on, that means if you don't bring them back later on, and they might have had something really interesting to say about something that we reveal later. So going through all the transcripts of all of these interviews, some of them are like 2, 3, 4 hours long, and we spent a lot of time with these people. We realized we had all of this material, and actually in the way that we've constructed the book is that it's not, it's a freer way of doing it. We can jump from person to person, and I think that helps when reading the book, that if you haven't heard of the story before, if you haven't watched the film, you are going to get a very full kind of picture of it. But even if you have watched the films, then you're going to start to be able to draw lines and comparisons and conclusions that you might not otherwise have done. So although they're very different, we think they're very complementary and they both kind of work well, but it's fun for us to, or it was certainly interesting for us to kind of look at telling those stories in a different way.
This idea that you would have this second interview, what I think is not so clear for the audience is that every story is looked at through other people's eyes other than the killer and from their perspective. So the anguish of the victim's families, the insights of the police, potentially attorneys and the jurors sometimes, and the pain for those that care for the inmate as well. But also in that there is often, I found, you discover different information that was then initially the prisoner had conveyed in the interview. Can you explain?
Yeah, that's right. And I think, the break between the first and second interviews is quite often, depending on which state you're filming in, provision of the court on our access to the prisoner. So that there has to be a break between, you have the 3 months between media access. So in most, but not every case, we do our initial interview and then we have to wait 3 months before we can get access to the prisoner and the prison again, which initially we thought might be a problem. But as it turned out, I think Ned really embraced that as part of the format of the series. It gave us time to then go away, rake through that first interview and then interview the other contributors to the show, the friends, the relatives, the family members, police, investigators.
It was a happy accident, really, wasn't it, Danny, in a weird way?
Yeah.
We established that in Texas was the first place we were looking, and there's a minimum 90 days between when you interview them, and you can only interview for 1 hour. So we thought, hang on, we wanted to go and hear these stories told by the killers themselves, but there's no way that they could cover everything we needed in the space of an hour. And that was our point. We said, why don't we just give them their first bite and then we'll come back 3 months later after we've managed to talk to everybody else and will they have their kind of reaction to that? And that kind of inspired then our thoughts about this kind of idea based on the jury service idea of having each contributor cover up one in turn. And that's really kind of where the format came from. But I think, as Danny, you were saying, it means also they're very different in the two interviews. Kind of that first interview, we don't press them, do we?
No, and I think it was important as well to gain the trust as well of the inmates, who obviously are telling us their story, and to allow them. So effectively, we've always said, and I've said this before in other interviews, that the first interview is their interview and the second interview is our interview. So we let them tell the story and the truth as they're prepared to tell it. And then we come back then armed with obviously more questions, but also better perspective we think may or may not have actually happened once we've spoken to everybody else involved. We can press a little harder in that second interview. And sometimes people absolutely stick their stories and that's the truth they're willing to share. And other times you'll see, both in the book and in the series on Netflix, you'll see the stories rather change quite dramatically in some cases.
Sometimes not always the way you expect them to. Sometimes they've not told you something in the first interview and you realize they're holding it back.
Yeah.
Or they're consciously trying not to share that information. They're trying to paint themselves in the best light. But of course, you go back 3 or 4 months later and you say, well, you know, you didn't reveal this particular part, but we've spoken to everybody else and you didn't tell us this thing, which makes you look far, far worse. And they might have a reason why, but also sometimes they just don't tell you things which you think were really key and would be really important to hear, things which might, you know, give kind of some sort of mitigation to their actions, or at least make you kind of think somewhat better of them. A lot of them are still being the victims of abuse, of violence abuse or sexual abuse of some sort. Some of them surprisingly open talking about that, others aren't. And it's only really when you hear from other family members or something else, you hear something about their background, which makes things a lot easier to understand, but they themselves didn't present that. So it's interesting. And we also decided that, you know, with the permission of the various people we interviewed, to play back to them the words which other people had said about them. Sometimes members of the victim's family who've been happy for that to happen, or prosecutor or an investigator, and getting their reaction to that, I think, is really important. And I think that gives the viewer a good chance to be able to sit and decide whether they, yeah, how they feel about that individual. And again, in the book, the same thing happens. You know, we play back quite a lot of stuff to them when we interview them. We don't necessarily include all of those in the films, but when we were writing the book, it gave us a chance to kind of give more of their reactions to the things they've heard said about them decades, you know, after the event.
Let me list the chapters that you do have, and then we'll go back right to the beginning and explore them a little bit further, and you can have some commentary on these extraordinary stories. The first story you have is the first chapter you have is Overkill, David Barnett. The second story is Intended Evil, Charles Chuck Thompson. The third is Trapped, Linda Couch. The fourth, Means to an End, James Robertson. Number five is Pyro Joe, Joey Murphy. Number six, Killer in the Eyes of the Law, Kenneth Foster. Then A Silent Order, Brandon Hutchison. Then A Family Affair, Deandra Buchanan. Then Crossing the Line, Kavona Flannoy. And the last story, Owning It, Charles Armantrout. Let's go to the first story, Overkill, with David Barnett. Can you just give a description of this story and why you chose it?
I mean, this was one that when it went out on Netflix got an incredibly strong reaction from the viewers. No, that, I think that's fair to say. As an interviewee, I think David comes across as open and likable, for want of a better word. And his story is tragic and very sad. His crime is probably one of the worst we've covered, in as much as he ends up killing his step-grandparents or foster grandparents, and effectively blacks out and can't remember. And he's accused of overkill, which is the title of the chapter and the film, because he stabbed them multiple times, which is, you know, quite a shocking crime. The background to the story is really layered, and it's a very sad and tragic story that I think we perhaps didn't, until we were deep into it and we'd done the interview and then started interviewing the other contributors, probably hadn't fully appreciated, Ned. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, when David was writing to us, this episode was that the film was directed by Zoe Hines, who's now produces the series with us. And David had been writing about sexual abuse he'd experienced from a very young age, and he'd been passed through the foster care system from person to person. He'd had only one experience of kind of suitable parenting at all, and that was fairly short-lived. And we knew it was very, very sad, but then we read a lot of letters from inmates. You never know fully to what degree they're telling the truth and to what degree they're embellishing on things, maybe just trying to get you to elicit sympathy from you. So we didn't know as we set out, but as it became clearer and clearer talking to other people who were close to David and family and friends and others, he was a deeply, deeply damaged child. And he had a very difficult relationship with his adopted father. It was his adopted father's parents who he ended up killing. And regardless of what you feel about, you know, the level of responsibility he has for that crime that he committed, I don't think there would be anyone who wouldn't consider his childhood and his background a mitigation of some sort, or at least it helps you to understand how he got there. And I think that's,
yes,
particularly in these sorts of stories where there is commonality of abuse. I think one of the psychiatrists that we, criminal psychologists we interviewed all the time, I think he put it very well. He said, you know, these awful backgrounds don't make you a killer. They don't mean because you've been abused or anything else that you're going to end up killing, but it just pushes you closer to the edge. It pushes you into a place where you are more likely to make those bad decisions, those tragic decisions, which can lead you to this place. And I don't think it's a coincidence. You know, you tend to find not many of the, we've written the thousands and thousands of inmates across the US of serving convictions for murder, serving sentences for murder. And most of them do not come from well-adjusted, stable families in middle-class suburbs. You know, it's not to say that the people who've grown up in nice environments can't turn out to be murderers, but they're surely just far, far less likely to do so. Where there is kind of pain and suffering in the childhood, it leads people into bad places. And when people are in bad places, they end up making bad decisions. And I think even if this wasn't a conscious decision from David, which is certainly what he claims, I think it's one of the stories which gives the kind of the, one of the best examples of that. We've included two of these stories in the book from people who had really disturbing childhood abuse. And we thought it was important because a great number of the cases we've learned about and we haven't managed to produce into documentaries or write up about for one reason or another, but so many of them have cited childhood abuse as being a factor in their lives.
In this story, though, there is another factor that is disturbing, and you say that, or someone says in this story, that it changed David dramatically. This is the issue that comes up in a number of stories in this book, in that some people go to police for help and they don't get the help they're looking for. Can you explain?
In this instance, no, to quote from, but David and his friend had gone to the authorities and tried to, raise their concerns and let them know the abuse that was happening in the house, and they didn't get support that they wanted. I mean, this is certainly David's version of events, and corroborated by his friend, and of course that did leave him frustrated. I guess at that point he felt he had nowhere else to turn. And as Ned said, this isn't, this had been going on a long time. He'd been in and out of care, and he had a really, really rough childhood. And I guess that, without using a cliche, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. I think he'd got to a point where he had no one to turn to. And so it's really sad.
Yeah, and when people do kind of make their claims to us and these backgrounds that they've received, it's incumbent on us as trial makers to kind of corroborate that or make it clear to the viewer what is known and what's not known. And I think, yes, David and his friend both testify that they went to inform the police and were not taken seriously. And certainly then when we speak to the people, the attorneys who were involved in his appeals, that was very much they had established themselves. And actually what they had was a very long record of instances of abuse that he had suffered, which had been known about. And that information wasn't presented in his first trial. As mitigation. And we spoke to all the jurors in that case who, I think, had he known that at the time, would have felt very, very different. And so it's not just the police didn't do it, but there were records there to show what was there. And even at the point when lives had been lost and his life was being judged, those things weren't taken to account in a court of law. Now, we're not trying to rewrite the legal proceedings. We very much feel that the law has had its part and it's done its part, and we're not here to campaign for anybody. We're not challenging convictions or anything else. But we are asking viewers, or allowing viewers and ourselves, the opportunity to judge these inmates as human beings. And I think if you don't have that information, which is corroborated and is supported, if you don't have that, then I don't think you can make a fair judgment. I don't think we're expecting viewers to decide what someone's sentence should be, but just judge to say, okay, can I understand that? Can I honestly say that if I'd had the same experiences as that person, would I not be in the same place they are now?
Let's use this as an opportunity to hear from these messages.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Now, the next story you have is Intended Evil, featuring Charles Chuck Thompson. Can you tell us, just outline what this story is about and the issues raised?
If I start this one, Danny, and you can, because I know that you, it's a film you particularly like. So Chuck Thompson was convicted of double murder, of killing his girlfriend or ex-girlfriend, depending on whose account you listen to, I will believe, and new boyfriend. Now, the part which was kind of interesting in this is that he had gone to where she lived. He'd had a fight with the other victim, but had returned sometime later, broken into the house. And he said it was a fight over a gun that he had shot the new boyfriend and then shot Denise, his partner or former partner, but that had been an accident. And she survived the shooting. She got shot through the jaw, I believe. But she later died in the hospital, and there were some accusations that it was through malpractice at the hospital, but I don't think that was covered. But once there was a second death, it was then a capital crime. So he moved from being possibly arguing as a manslaughter or accidental killing to a double homicide, facing the death penalty. And I think the part which was, for me, the strongest in this film was hearing from his victim's son, Wade, who was only about 12 or 13 years old at the time that his mother was killed. But the way that he was able to and willing to speak about his experiences and the measured way that he talked about it and his opinions of Chuck Thompson, for me, Daddy, that's what I thought was the really interesting point in the film.
Yeah, I think that interview really brought the whole film together and gave it the real core of the film, I think, comes through Wade. And it's heartbreaking. Obviously, he's lost a mother. There's no real explanation for it. And Chuck Thompson doesn't really, at any point, I think you'll agree, that take responsibility.
No. Was his line, he said, "Oh, I didn't kill her, the hospital did." You know, it's like, yeah, she wouldn't be in a hospital if he hadn't shot her in the head. I mean, that, I think that's...
She died from complications due to the bullet that he shot that was lodged in her head. I mean, there's absolutely no way that Chuck Thompson, in my opinion, was not responsible for that crime. And whilst he admitted, which is absolutely part of the premise for I'm a Killer, that he was there and pulled the trigger, he wouldn't take responsibility for death. And I think what's interesting, having made, you know, a few of these and with the team, and we sit and we watch them and we critique each other's work and we talk about the stories and how they've affected us, that quite often we all come to some agreement of how sympathetic or empathetic we are to the character. And I think Chuck Thompson was one that elicited quite a strong response from the group involved in making the film.
But the other part, Danny, and Dan, you were saying earlier about the first interview, I think Chuck Thompson was a particularly interesting one on this, because what he chose not to reference in the first interview was something which we later then found out, which was that he had, after the killing, he had spoken to a female friend of his and told her what had occurred, and she became a leading witness against him. And whilst he was in prison, he spoke to an undercover cop who he didn't know was an undercover cop and attempted to solicit that individual to execute the witness in his trial. That recording, phone recording, was deemed inadmissible in court, but for various legal reasons, but it doesn't mean that it's still relevant or true. And therefore we could include in the film. And I think Chuck, to me at least, I don't know if you feel the same, Danny, exhibited a kind of a level of arrogance. He thought because it'd been deemed inadmissible in court, but therefore it didn't exist anymore and we would never find out about it. And playing that recording to him in the second interview, the director, she said that the look on his face, he felt totally confident that he had presented himself and got everybody inside. You know, he's a superficially charming guy. And I think he thought that everyone was kind of in his pocket. And then when he heard that, he was like, "Oh, you've got that, you know." And I think that was a really revealing kind of moment to see his reaction. And he kind of go, "You chose to be involved in this production and in this project. And you had the opportunity here to speak openly and truthfully. And you chose to withhold information and kind of try and present a different version of events." And I think that was really telling. Like Danny says, thinking there's a varying level of empathy and sympathy that the members of our team have for different inmates to one degree or another. But Charles Thompson is one of those, I think he's on the lower end of that.
You talk about empathy and sympathy, and the next story is called Trapped, with Linda Couch. So again, a female representative here. She's in her mid-60s, and you'd speak to her at the Ohio Reformatory, and this is over the claim of the death of her husband, which she claims is an accident. Tell us just a little bit about what you found with this story, Trapped.
Yeah, this is slightly different, because this actually was a case that got a fair amount of news coverage at the time, Ned, wasn't it? Which is unlike a lot of the I'm a Killer stories. Certainly, it was picked up on the news and the local news stations, because it's a woman who has killed her husband and claims it's an accident, effectively in self-defense, that the husband's come at her with a gun and they've struggled and he's been killed. But then she panics and hides the body. And I think that's where what really drove the sort of interest in the news story, that she initially had hidden the body of her husband in the basement and then enlisted the help of her children to move the body to the garden where she buries the body wrapped in carpet. But then subsequently the police discover the body and she's arrested for murder. And obviously the fact that she's disposed of the body doesn't help in her defence, in her claims that it was an act of self-defence. But she tells a story of years of spousal abuse, physical and mental abuse at the hands of her husband. The abuse often came violent. And it was during one of these fights that a gun went off and her husband was killed. So on the face of it, relatively straightforward and, you know, sympathetic elements, obviously the tragic murder of her husband, but of the victim, Linda, who I think had, you know, quite genuinely had been through an extremely tough time in a very difficult marriage. But then, you know, as we investigate further and, you know, partially what came up in court and then we heard later, there was elements that suggested the murder was premeditated, but obviously completely changes the complexion of the case. The gun wasn't her husband's. It was a gun that she'd bought just days prior to the murder. The kids had been sent to stay with the relatives.
She'd transferred the deed of the house into her name only a few weeks before in a forged document.
Yeah, and made some financial altercations to the bank account. So, you know, in the days leading up to the murder. So all of this points to a premeditated murder and not at all the struggle for a gun in an argument with her husband that she suggested in court. And that's what the court decided. And Linda's been in prison for a very, very long time. But regardless of the premeditation or not, I think, you know, that it's definitely enough evidence, certainly, that Linda, you know, did suffer in that relationship. She perhaps was pushed to the brink. But again, for the audience to decide.
Well, I think it's an interesting one, Danny. I think it was an interesting case. I think one of the parts that the prosecutor in that case, we interviewed from film, and we quote him in the book as well. There was quite a lot of social media comments about things that he'd said, because he said, you know, she claims to have had a history of domestic abuse. And he says, well, why didn't she say? And rightly, I think a lot of people jump on that and say, well, hang on, you know, this is people who suffer domestic abuse often don't say it. We know that to be the case. They will suffer in silence. But I think the part which struck me as interesting is that she didn't raise this as a defense at the time of her trial. Now, I understand why people might not say, you know, out of fear and the control nature of abusive relationships, they might not say until the point that they snap or something happens and they end up in a situation like she did with her husband dead. But she didn't actually reference this defense at her trial. And I think that was interesting. There might be reasons why. I think she suggests that she was advised not to, that it wouldn't go down well with the jury or for whatever reason. But I thought that was an interesting part, because this is one of the first female cases that we covered. And certainly something which was eminently clear, even right from the very first female cases we were looking at, but has become abundantly clear with all the ones we find on, is that the commonality in female cases is about domestic abuse. It's very rare that we've corresponded with a female murderer who hasn't stated that they've been a victim of domestic abuse at some point. Of course, you know, they might all be true, but they might not all be true. And I think that's that, just that element of doubt there. And although I don't think it was a healthy marriage, certainly my impression of it was it was not a happy marriage or a healthy marriage. And I don't think she was in a happy place. It's not entirely sure if that is the case, that the abuse happened the way that she said it did. And we interviewed her daughter, who now lives in Ghana in Africa, which was a surprise to us, having left Ohio. And it was quite a trip for our team to go out and film her over there.
Yes.
And she relates very much to some of the abuse that happened, but then also suggesting that some of the things weren't true. So our point was not to say that we know. These are not the definitive tellings of this story. We are not saying that we know the answer one way or the other, but I think there are question marks there. And it's up to, you know, the same way as we as documentarians are making up, you know, trying to establish our own understanding of a case. We think it's important to allow the viewers to present them with the information that we have and the testimony that we have from various connected parties and allow them to make that choice. She's a very old lady, a grandmotherly figure, and it's difficult not to feel kind of sympathy for her as she spent so long in jail. But the details of her case were somewhat complicated.
I think it's another good example of one that did divide opinion, you know, with some members of the team obviously feeling very sorry for a woman that whose story is very believable, you know, and quite often victims of domestic abuse aren't believed, or they choose to keep quiet because they're ashamed or they're scared of the consequence, especially when there's children involved in the relationship. And so there was a great deal of sympathy for on that level. And there were others that, you know, look at the facts, looked at everything that pointed to premeditated murder, which undermines some, not all, of Linda's claims. So again, it was, and I think it's a really good example of one that it's not straightforward. These stories aren't straightforward. We probably ask more questions than we answer, but there's a lot for the viewer there to take in. And you know, we're not coming down on anyone's side. And of course, we always remain respectful of the victim and their family. So it's another one that is open-ended, but it raises so many issues. And as Ned said, touching on things, spousal or domestic abuse and the like is another thing that, you know, another corner that we've gone into with I Am a Killer.
Let's stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. Are you someone that has experienced bloating so bad you've avoided a social get-together? Many women experience it. Ritual literally created Symbiotic Plus with that specific problem in mind. It contains clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic to support a balanced gut microbiome. My wife Lisa and I have been taking Ritual's multivitamins for a few years, and when Ritual introduced their Symbiotic Plus, we both start taking it immediately. We both trust Ritual and their research, and we both take Symbiotic Plus in addition to our Ritual multivitamin every day. Daily 3-in-1 prebiotic, probiotic, and postbiotic with two of the world's most clinically studied probiotic strains to support the relief of mild and occasional bloating, gas, and diarrhea. Why include a postbiotic? It provides fuel to the cells that make up the gut lining and supports a healthy gut barrier. Win-win. Delayed release capsule design to help survive the harsh conditions of the upper GI tract for delivery to the colon, an ideal place for probiotics to grow and thrive. Symbiotic Plus and Ritual are here to celebrate, not hide, your insides. There's no more shame in your gut game. That's why Ritual is offering my listeners 30% off during your first month. Visit ritual.com/murder. to start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today. Let's talk about Means to an End. And James Robertson, you had mentioned it briefly as part of the series. James Robertson, it's interesting for the heinous crimes of this James Robertson for there to be any reason for you guys to cover this story, given that you don't want to cover sensationalized stories and you don't want to go into any of the typical true crime analysis of his crimes or his personality or anything. Tell us why Means to an End has been included.
He obviously is an example of somebody that didn't go to prison. He's been in prison for his entire adult life, but he didn't go to prison for murder. He was an adolescent at the time of his original crime, which is a breaking and entry. Is that right, Ned?
Yeah, he tried to steal a stereo, I believe.
I think it was robbing a Radio Shack. Yeah.
Yeah.
Once he got into the criminal system, the criminal justice system and the prison system as a very young man, he was really borderline adolescent at the time, whether or not he was going to be in juvenile detention or an adult incarceration. And he went into the prison system and just got worse and worse and worse, and his crimes multiplied. And I think he became very much a product of his environment, not that he wasn't. He was already he'd already fallen into criminality as a boy, as a teenager. But I think we're seeing somebody that went down a very particular path once he got into the prison system, where there was no real attempts at rehabilitation, and he became violent and molded himself to his environment in a way. And he was very physically capable of violence, and that became his way of life once he was in the prison system. And he eventually ends up killing somebody in prison in an attempt to get off the, you know, out of the general population and onto death row, where he thought he could live the remainder of his life in prison in a more comfortable environment. So absolutely institutionalized, absolutely, you know, a product of the prison system, but, you know, spent his whole adult life in prison and for a large portion of that in solitary confinement or close management, as they call it.
Well, I think the best, which there was a few ones about James, which grabbed us immediately. I mean, first of all, when you see him and just seeing his inmate photos, he is you know, he's straight from central casting in terms of what you would imagine a dangerous psychopathic killer would look like. I mean, he does look terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And that contrasted massively with the letters that we received from him, not in what he wrote, way he wrote. His handwriting is delicate and small and reminded me of our school friend I had, an Asian school friend I had, who used to draw little hearts over her eyes. It was very odd, but he wrote well and he was extremely open about it. He says, yeah, I killed and I should be sent to death row for that. And that just struck us as bizarre. But because he'd been in the prison system since the age of 17, we weren't sure we could find enough voices to be able to actually make this film to kind of cover it. The victim didn't have any surviving family who would talk to us, and not a lot was known about him. And in fact, he didn't use that person or anything specifically that they'd done, according to James. He'd just chosen somebody that he could kill to get on death row. But also, it's not easy to speak to people who are actually still employed by the prison system. So we weren't sure. And in that first season, our teams went out and we filmed 14 inmates. And then we chose of those the 10 that we would go ahead with. And I remember receiving a call from the director, Ross Yell, who just interviewed James Robertson. And he called and he said, I know it's going to be a difficult story to tell, but he is the most remarkable figure. This is one of the most remarkable interviews I've ever done. I mean, he's terrifying, but there is something else in there which is interesting. And I think that's kind of, you know, when I heard that from Ross and I spoke to Danny, I think we just decided, okay, let's just have a look at this. What else can we find? And we found some really interesting people, his attorney, the nurse who works at the prison there, who could testify about him and his behavior. And then most especially finding his cousin, Daryl Losher, who made contact with him, with James, whilst James, and since James had committed the murder. And the two were very similar in so many ways. The one had a loving family and stability, and the other one didn't. And I think that's what you then started to see, a human element about James in the way that he communicated with his cousin and with his cousin's children. And they, you know, Daryl even took his children to go and visit their uncle James, who's this monstrous looking chicken. And in that film, the second interview with him, he was different. He was very different. I mean, he's still the same person who has the same history of violent crime within the prison system, somebody who willingly murdered another human being just to try to better his situation. You know, they're terrible, awful things, but he...
Have you heard? Sling TV offers the news you love for less.
Hey, wait. You look and sound just like me. I am you. I'm the same news programs on Sling TV for less.
You mean you're me, but for less money.
A lot less. I'm all the favorite news programs and more on Sling TV starting at just $40 a month.
Everything great about me, but for less money?
Which makes me greater, don't you think? Get the news you love and more for less.
Start saving today. Visit sling.com to see your offer.
Sling. Wasn't the caricature that I think he wanted to portray in that first interview. He wanted to be shocking. He wanted that kind of reaction from us. And once we spoke to him again and we knew more about him and his life, he spoke very differently. And I think, as I said before, you know, it's just to make us, as all of us as viewers, to watch these, just to judge these people as human beings, because he is a human being and he's not actually a monster. He's not necessarily a nice human being. He's certainly not someone you might want to spend and go on a camping trip with or anything like that. But he is a human being, and there are human elements to him, which I think you can start to understand a bit. So I thought that was a really important story for us to uncover.
And I think it's a little bit of an old adage, cliche, but James basically says it himself that in prison you either get better or you get worse. And he chose a path like quite purposefully, you know, chose to not to be dominated and not to succumb to it. And he sort of almost embraced that lifestyle in prison to the point where it was almost inevitable that he was going to commit further crimes, and his prison sentence was just going to escalate until he ended up on death row, which is at that point where he wanted to be.
But if he'd behaved himself and he put his head down, he could have been out maybe after 6 years or 8 years, I think it was. Yeah, that was a possibility.
Yeah, I think it might have been less than that for his initial crime.
Instead, he's there 40 years and then ends up on death row, and I think he has 111 years of additional sentencing on top of that. So, yeah.
Yeah, he'll never see the outside of a prison cell.
Let's use this as an opportunity to hear from these messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time. No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What I think one of the themes in some of these stories, just to go off on a little tangent, was this often misdirected anger and violence. There's a few stories with this where the wrong people are targeted from the abuse that they experienced.
Well, rarely are the victims directly connected with the abuse or mishaps that the killers have experienced in early life. Obviously, Linda Couch's story is different. That she, or at least her version is that she killed her abuser. But yeah, that's not often, on certainly not always the case. And you're right; it's that sort of the violence is directed, not necessarily to the source of the pain or the trouble. But again, and I do have to keep reiterating, although it's something we all feel very strongly about raising these issues, that there's no way that these terrible conditions which these people grew up in, you know, and often horrendous abuse and they've suffered, excuses taking another person's life.
No.
And, you know, these people, all of them, or everybody with which I've made very, very bad decisions, clearly, that have had tragic outcomes. So I think we just need to, you know, we do need to keep as passionate as we are about making these circumstances known and the conditions and raising the issues. I think we do have to remind ourselves of that. You know, there's a victim in all of these crimes.
There is. And I think, though, that what it does show, like you say, Dan, that the victims of being the misdirected rage, is that, you know, the assumption that we have that people who commit murder are either horrific psychopathic beasts or really calculated, manipulative characters. I think what it shows with these ones is these are not, the vast majority of the murders that we cover are not thought through crimes. These are not criminal masterminds. They are often not planned at all. They're often the result of just a moment's kind of actions. We're interested in what has led to that kind of snapping moment, that moment where someone kind of does this thing. Yeah, James Robertson, he had planned and intended to kill his cellmate for his own benefit, but a large numbers of the others, no, these haven't been kind of pre-planned and thought through. These are criminal masterminds. Most murderers are not. The kind of the fictionalized depiction of murderers is certainly from the cases that we've been reading over these many years. That kind of characterization of the criminal mastermind doesn't seem to appear in the vast majority of cases.
Let's talk about Charles Billy Armitrout, speaking of fascinating cases and misdirected rage. You talk about that at 18 years old, he shot his father 6 times, but narrowly avoiding killing him. But 10 years later, he beat his 81-year-old grandma to death. The interesting thing was that for 15 years in prison, he claimed he was innocent and named another man as the killer. Can you tell us a little bit about this story of Billy Armitrout?
I think this is a story that both Danny and I were determined would be in the book, and we have it as the final chapter as well, for a very specific reason, because the contrast is that the crimes that Billy Armitrout committed were possibly the most horrific we'd come across. You know, he shot his father, but his father had survived. He was a meth addict. He was thoroughly self-absorbed, self-obsessed, dangerous individual, and he beat his grandmother to death with a baseball bat in order to steal money for drugs. And you just cannot. And then blamed it on his friend. And you can't really think of anything much worse than that. But I think, for me, certainly, is the interview with Charles Armitrout was remarkable, because he knows he's not going anywhere. He knows there's nowhere for him to go. So when he's never getting out of prison. And the sense that I had, and I think Danny feels the same, is that when he's telling us what he did, which he didn't do, which he didn't admit to for such a very long time, he's not doing it with, there is no other motivation apart from owning it, which is the name of the title of that chapter and the title of the film that it was based from. He owns what he did. And for me, or certainly I believe he does. And that for me makes him one of the most interesting murderers that we've spoken to. He's, Danny, I don't know, you feel very passionate about this story.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it was one, he ends up being an episode in series 2, although he was one of the first people we contacted right at the start of the process. And it took a year in pre-production, the first series, with the letter writing and getting access to the various prisons and the institutions. But so he was one of the people we've been talking to the very longest time, but timing didn't work out for the first series. And when we got to interview him for the second, you know, so we were really interested to do this. So one, because that is, you picked up on, Dan, that for 15 years, he absolutely adamant that his friend, the guy that he was hired with at the time, was the murderer in this instance, in the murder of his grandmother. And 15 years into his prison sentence, with nothing to gain, he changed the tune and told the truth. And I think partly he was he was deeply addicted to various drugs, and it was a meth addict at the time of his grandmother. I think there was a lot of, genuinely a lot of confusion. But I think also he's been lying to himself for so long and telling the same story in court and in the various prison therapy sessions and the workshops. And he'd been telling the same story again and again and again. I think he genuinely believed it. I think at any point in those first 15 years of his prison sentence, you'd asked him, you'd got exactly the same answer. And he genuinely believed that he wasn't responsible. He couldn't come to terms with what he'd done. And his grandmother was one of the only people in his life that I think had really...
Well, she took him in, didn't she, when no one else would?
Yeah, cared for him in that way. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think he couldn't come to terms with it. And then he did. It was almost, not in a religious sense, but an epiphany of sorts. And he decided to take responsibility for his actions. And that's how he's chosen to live out the rest of his time in prison, with the full burden of his crimes. And he's quite, he's an old man now. He went in as a relatively young man, and he's an old guy, balding old guy with a grey moustache and glasses, telling you this story, and there's so much. It's very, it's no less tragic, or on his crime no less horrifying, but it's a whole life he lost the day he took his grandmother's life.
We interviewed him for about a total, I think, over 3 hours, so there's a lot that he spoke about, and I think that was a big part that we wanted to include extra parts about what he talked about in the book, because I could just sit and listen to his whole interview all the way through. It's, as Daddy says, he's this old guy. Something slightly kind of monk-like about him. He's kind of quiet and straightforward person. But knowing that he has nothing to gain from telling people and telling us what he did, telling us that he's truly remorseful for it, I think really, really strikes a chord. It doesn't, one of the phrases that we hear so very, very often corresponding with inmates is they say, I'm not that. The person I am now is not the person who I was then.
Right.
And of course, you'd expect that. You'd expect them to say, I committed that crime, but I'm different now. I'm better now. Let me out. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard. We have footage that we found of Charles being interviewed by police shortly after the murder, and he was still high on crack. And you look at the images of that and the images of the man that we interview, and it's difficult to believe this is the same man. And he's not arguing to be released. He's not arguing for his case to be reconsidered. He's not doing any of those things. He's just, as he says, he's owning it. He says, once the bell rings, it can't be unraveled. This is what I've done. And I think none of us would want to be judged for the single worst action we've ever taken in our lives. And we well more than that. But there's something about Charles who he accepts that's defined his life and where he is. And I think that's the part that he still struggles with. I mean, we tried, Henry Danny, to be impartial as filmmakers and not to put forward our feelings too much about the individuals, and just allow the viewers to make up their own mind. But I think both you and I were very keen on this story, because I think we just both kind of believe that this is a guy who is being honest. And what a remarkable thing to hear something that you, honest recollections from somebody who committed a crime so awful. But how do you live with yourself? And I think that's a really important lesson for us to learn.
You write that he changed his life, and it was because of this confession, it was a powerful turnaround in his life. Tell us who Wendy and Mary are and its impact on them.
Well, Charles had a pretty divided up family. His father doesn't sound like he was an easy person to be the son of, and his father had remarried. And so Charles had a stepmother and a stepsister for a period in his life. And he then robbed from them and was intimidating to them as well. And he had to have any kind of communication with them, and he didn't have any communication with the rest of his family. But as a result of us making this film, it's incumbent on us to try and approach and to speak to everybody who we can, who's connected to the individual. And Wendy and Mary were really interesting, inspiring individuals, his former stepmother and stepsister. They took it upon themselves that they wanted to reconnect with Charles. And that's true. As a result, Wendy went to visit him in prison, speak to him, and they believe they've remained in communication since. So we often get asked, why do you give these people a platform, and do you pay them? Do they get money for this? But frankly, no. We're not intending to give people a platform. We're just trying to learn from the things they have to say. And nobody would ever get paid, and we wouldn't give anyone any kind of compensation to talk about crimes they committed. But I think it'd be fair to say that Charles from this one has received a benefit from it. And that's because he's managed to reconnect with somebody who they knew him as a young boy. They knew him before he became the person who committed those terrible crimes. And now they know him as the person who has changed once again. So, yeah, it's a very moving story, I think.
Absolutely. I want to thank you both, Fanny Tipping and Ned Parker, for coming on and talking about I Am a Killer, What Makes a Murderer, their shocking stories in their own words. For those that might want to take a further look, tell us about your Netflix series. You say it's in the fourth season now. And tell us how they might find out more information about this book and any social media that you both partake in.
There's four seasons available right now on Netflix internationally. Just search I Am a Killer.
And there's also the accompanying series, I'm a Stalker.
Yeah, so that was a spin-off very similar to I'm a Killer, as much as we interview convicted stalkers who talk about their crimes. But of course, in this instance, we get to meet their victims as well. And that's a real eye-opener, because I think stalking was a crime that we knew even less about than murder.
Wow.
So there's I'm a Killer, there's 8 episodes of I'm a Stalker, and a book which is out in September in the US, which will be available from all your favorite bookstores and online retailers.
That's great. Thank you so much, Danny Tipping and Ed Parker.
Thank you, Dan. Been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much, and you have a great evening and good night.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Dan.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Bye.
Bye-bye.